My plan this evening is to read an excerpt from Empty Words, number 3. I wrote a text which is in my book M, called Muro. That is the first syllable of music, followed by the second syllable of Thoreau, Muro. And it used all the parts of speech, sentences, phrases, words, syllables, and letters. Having written it, I decided to go farther in making a non-syntactical language, and the first step would be to remove sentences using only phrases, words, syllables, and letters. That was the first part of Empty Words. The second part removes the phrases, and the third part, an excerpt from which I will read to you, removes the words, except of course the words which are of only one syllable. As a whole, the empty words start, of course, from a language which is not ordinary language, and it moves to a language which is, so to speak, no language at all, but approaches the state of music, the sounds of letters and silences. This one, part 3, is a little past the halfway point, more toward the side of music, that is to say, more toward the side of sound than the side of sense. Not quite a year ago, I began a meeting with an audience of this size in California, and it was found that the sound of the sound system was not very good. This one also is not excellent. Furthermore, my voice is not very good. Some years ago, I gave up smoking, and as a result, there's been a kind of a cloud over my voice ever since. However, if you find that the performance of this Empty Words is hopeless, it will be partly my fault and partly the fault of the sound system and the architecture. Could we have the lights out now? The perch great hind and 10. Have and the withal need that I as be there of sparrow. Huskle on a row as the shelf, not unhouse the ing shaped wook wood un stwati bawa the dahi release gus deb tuk anplug ang sisurak I hurt rook to the snow suddenly. And to show differently belief era e k o s s burns s e c an o what freeze Think. 3. Grind in the of the shall-dal, if is and hard, curring this is cold in the weeds should in and unsealed so with as un Lee by Sim Bond Feel Foot Jinwu and the Zul Andries Allah to glowish in Ankto E I'm not trying to say anything. I'm doing something, which is were you here at the beginning? I was making a composition of non-syntactical language which didn't have any sentences in it, and in what you just heard had only syllables and letters. And that, there you don't have to try, you rather do, and you observe then what happens when you do that.
For me it was like a mantra, you know, cows were grazing, and you could hear their bell the whole day, but they kept changing, but you weren't aware of them at all times.
I think this is the young lady says it was like a mantra, and that she became aware of in a different way than you would be if the language were ordinary language. I think the first thing that one notices is that in the silences he becomes aware of what's happening in them, and that ordinarily we tend to ignore that when we're paying attention to what we call sense.
Do you ever use the I Ching to somehow direct the theme?
This question has to do with whether I sometimes use the I Ching not to do with the numbers, but to do with the wisdom, which is the nature of the book. It is called a book of wisdom. It answers questions. I use it that way when I have a question of that kind. But when I am making a composition, I don't use it that way.
What's the nature of your compositional questions?
In this case, where I was using only syllables and letters, my first question was, What am I dealing with? Am I dealing with syllables or letters or a combination of syllables and letters? Because when you have two such things, there are no other possibilities than either one or the combination.
Well, sometimes that
relates to a yes, no answer. It doesn't. It has an, there are three possibilities. So it's a question of one, two, or three. Whereas in yes and no, it's a question of one and two. We can ask questions that have to do with five possibilities, etc. Then my next question, after finding out what it was I was doing at the beginning, was, and how long am I doing it? For how many events? And then I would take the answer directly from the I Ching, that is to say the number that it gave, say it was the number 47. Then if I had had, as the answer to the first question, a combination of syllables and letters, and my second answer was 47 of them, then my next question is, well, which of these 47 are syllables and which are letters? And then it was a question of one or two. Do you see?
So in a way, it becomes a collage of the syllable and the letters?
I think you could say that. You could also say it's a process of obtaining answers, a process that could go on, that has significant beginning and no significant ending and no middle, that one is constantly at the point of asking a question. My next question was, in the case of this text, was of the 14 volumes of Thoreau's journal, say I'm looking for a syllable, out of which volume does it come? And say I get the answer, the ninth volume. Then I have previously counted the pages in the ninth volume and related that number of pages to the number 64. And so I then say, in which page of the ninth volume is it? And by two answers from the I Ching, because the number exceeds 64, number of pages exceeds it, I then find the group of pages that it's in, and then the page in the group that it's in. And then I find the line that the syllable is on. Then when I get to the line, I count the syllables in the line, and finally pinpoint the syllable and inscribe it. When the syllables are letters that I found in this way were in italics, that was when I gave them a different kind of vocalization than simple reading.
What determined the use of Thoreau's journal?
The question is what determined the use of Thoreau's journal rather than something else? That was the question of you might say, combination of taste and personal experience. When I was introduced by the poet Wendell Berry to the journal of Thoreau, I immediately responded as though I were thirsty. I couldn't do without it. So that I read it starting from the beginning, and then I began flying by means of chance operations over it and into it and making things with it. Then I discovered, to my surprise, and it took me years to discover this, that those drawings are beautiful. Because when they were in the book illustrating it, they merely had meaning. They merely seemed significant or trying to say something. Whereas when, through circumstances, I took them out of the journal and when they lost their meaning and were no longer illustrating anything, at least to my way of thinking, they became beautiful. and beautiful both in the sense of what we call our modern art, and in the sense of Japanese art. And what characterizes them is that they're devoid of self-expression. Even when he was very young, Thoreau said he wished to get out of the picture, so to speak, and to learn to write in such a way that nothing would stand between the reader and what it was that Thoreau had seen and was describing by means of words.
Have you always used this method for writing?
The question is whether I've always used this method for writing. I began to use the chance operations of the I Ching in 1952. And for a few years before that, I used another way to free my work of my taste and memory. And that way that I used was the magic square. Benjamin Franklin is said to have made the largest magic square. But I made one, and then instead of putting numbers in them as he had, or as one does normally, I put sounds, and I made musical compositions by moving, taking, say, the knight's move in chess, and getting, in that way, a sequence of sounds for a composition.
Guide your life by that in a way? Do you refer to it every day?
There are circumstances in our lives where we oughtn't to use chance operations. In, for instance, crossing a street. And in my own case, in the playing of chess, or in the picking of wild mushrooms for the table. But there is a tendency, I think we to get it from some of our education, to think that if something works in one part of our lives, that it should work in all the others. I think that's a result of what I call German thinking. If you think in terms of India, they already divided philosophy into four departments that were separate from one another. And the first is called artha, where you move toward goals, as in picking mushrooms or crossing streets or playing chess. You want to win and you don't want to kill yourself. And then you have different ideas and different ways of acting in the field of kama than you do in that field of goal seeking. Kama has to do with the giving of pleasure, the arts and love, traditionally. Dharma has to do with what is true and false. And moksha has to do with the liberation from all these concerns. Now, chance operations have to do, obviously, with moksha. And they can have, these different departments or categories can have effects upon one another. You are familiar, I believe, in the field of art with the notion that if something fulfills a function, that it is automatically beautiful. This is an idea that has been found in modern architecture. Buckminster Fuller feels that way. If he makes one of his Dymaxion domes, he turned to me once and smiled and said, "Isn't it beautiful?" And it was. And so I think that the notion of liberation from these concerns can have an effect upon our perception of beauty. Beauty is, after all, merely a word which means that we approve of whatever it is. And this led Wittgenstein to say that beauty merely means that something clicks, and that if, by chance, something doesn't click, he advised having a clicker in your pocket so that you could take it out and transform the world in front of you.
What is it?
These chance operations, do you really remove human choice and move away from some sort of self-expression? Don't you come down at some point to having to make some choice that is really a human one, or a personal one?
I don't think it's impersonal to learn to ask questions. I gave a talk, something like this, talking about these ideas at a university that specializes in music in the state of New York, up at Potsdam. That evening there was a party in the home of the head of the music department, and his wife was arranging the house. I was sitting there, and she said, "I have a question for you. I have been talking as I am now about asking questions." And I said, "What is it?" And I don't remember exactly what she asked, but it went in this way. It said, "Don't you think that I'm right when I say, or when I feel, such and such a way?" And I said, "That's not a question, that's a request for agreement." But it's very difficult to ask a question which encompasses a field of possibilities. It's difficult for us to know what it is we want to know, or even what it is we want to do. It's that kind of situation we're in with respect to the application of our knowledge of the sciences, of our technology. We don't really know yet what it is we would like to have in the world. We go on thinking that we want oil, for instance. We ought to know, we're being told constantly in a variety of ways, that we oughtn't to have oil, or at least we oughtn't to be relying on it the way we are. Yet we refuse to ask the right question that will lead to the right answers. And to call that inhuman or lacking in humanity to learn to ask questions is simply to stay at the point of not asking the right questions. Yes.
What do you think it is, or how do you think it is that we have gotten to a point, or maybe always were at the point where we couldn't ask the right questions, or weren't open to asking those questions? What causes that?
You mean, why don't people ask? Well, they seem to think that it's better to make choices.
The
question is, do I have an idea as to why people... Do you agree with what I said about choices as opposed to asking questions? Okay. The question then is, why do I think people prefer asking, making choices than asking questions?
Yeah, because you can never get away from making choices. You'll never be free from making choices.
I think you can be. You can become freer at any rate, and you can become more open. You see, if you make choices, don't you think that you will make the right choice rather than the wrong one? No, really, seriously. If between, say you're concerned with beauty, wouldn't you choose what was beautiful rather than what was ugly? Okay? Then your notion of beauty will remain what it was. So you won't move at all. You'll stay just where you were.
Yes, I understand.
But by asking questions, you will change.
Yeah, you will grow. So if you have to be stagnant, you have to, you always have to grow.
At any rate,
no, but I
have, what's your question?
Well, my question was if you had any theory or whatever as to why it was that we worked that way as opposed to working the way of asking questions.
When I was studying with Suzuki, he drew a circle on the blackboard. It was more like an egg shape. And halfway up the left side, he put two parallel lines. And he said, this is the ego. And he said, the whole thing is the structure of the mind. And he said, the ego has the capacity of cutting itself off from its experience, whether it comes to it from the outer world through the senses, or whether it comes from the inner world through the dreams. The ego can still protect itself and cut itself off, or it can become open to those, to that other world. And he said, what Zen would like is that we go full circle. Seeing this notion of going full circle and knowing that the practice in the Orient is to sit square-legged and go in, I decided to establish disciplines that would do, so to speak, the same thing, that is to say, not rely on the ego, but open it up, but instead of going in, would go out. So I made these disciplines that free the work from the things that characterize the ego, which are taste, memory, etc., likes and dislikes.
Did you desire to communicate?
I think in this discussion period that I'm making every effort to answer your questions, and so I desire, so to speak, to answer your questions. But when I was reading the text, which I had written, I had neither in the reading nor in the writing of it any intention other than to do what I've described that I was doing, which is to make a text that was non-syntactical and that had simply syllables and letters in it, a mix with silences. And I see everywhere around me the bad effects of language making sense. It's conceivable that we can get some good effects from language making nonsense. Coming back to that, those divisions of Indian thinking, there are occasions when making sense is essential, and other cases when it isn't. And I don't think we should think in the terms of which is more important. I think we should give our attention to things at their own times without thinking that something is less or more.
Yes.
You received a strong response from the Road Journal. Why did you feel that you had made that public?
You mean, why did I decide to do any of my own work? You may have struck a soft point, I don't know. when I wake up with energy and I get to work rather quickly in the morning, and I keep at it through the day, I don't think I have the idea that I'm making it public, but the public apparently has that idea.
Given that there can be means of creative expression that employ techniques which are not masterable, and whose methodology is chance in nature, What sort of attitude can an artist take then to the acquiring of the craft aspects of the medium?
I think we're dealing not so much with what you call the craft aspects of your medium as we are dealing with the mind. I'm convinced of that. And that it's the mind, that the structure of which I just described in Suzuki's terms, that either can become open or remains closed. I never saw one of his classes, but I did know Mark Tobey. And one of the ways he had of teaching painting, drawing, was by having the students sit around a still life. And when he asked them whether they'd seen it sufficiently so that they could close their eyes and remember it, when they all said yes, then he sent them to the walls where he had put, where there wasn't a blackboard, but where he had put paper. And he obliged them to stand at the wall with their toes and their nose touching it, and not permitted, and didn't permit them to remove either the nose or the toes, and to take a charcoal and to draw what they had seen. What happened then was that the mind was put out of control. And what you might, what did you call it? The craft aspects of the medium, they came into charge. And each one of them made actually a beautiful drawing that was free of that self-concern. And that's why the craft aspects, the charcoal became charcoal. What disappeared is what was involved in your question of perhaps of what we call, of what you called humanity. But from a Buddhist point of view, it might be that when that humanity disappeared, humanity appeared.
I'd like to know a little bit more of what you mean by making sense.
Wants to know what I'm a little bit more about what I mean by making sense. When you have the word tree, and you have a tree, and when you think of the word tree as referring to the tree, then the word is making sense. But when you have the word tree and are content with it, without its referring to the tree, then you're having what I was calling no sense, which is, of course, another sense. Is that all right?
That's okay. Makes sense.
Oh, yes.
What does growth mean to you as an artist?
What does what?
What does growth mean to you? How do you define that word in terms of your career as an artist? In terms of
I didn't get it. Didn't.
Growth.
What does growth mean to me? It's very curious, and it's an interesting question, because I don't think that this business of changing that is implicit in the notion of growth leaves us, at least I hope it doesn't. Gertrude Stein said that everyone considers himself a mature young man. And I go on thinking that I have things to discover that I haven't discovered. And then I look back at, say, well, as I was required to do a little while ago, to 1952, and I remember thinking that I was fairly grown up then. But many things have happened since then. And this year, some years one seems to do more, and there seems to be more activity than other years. And in my own case, this year of 77, 78 is extraordinary. I'm doing so many different things. If I'm in a room, I can look to eight different parts of it and see eight different people doing things. I mean, there are eight different things that I could be doing. And I don't see in the nature of that living, there's nothing but going on growing. There is, of course, death coming, but it's not in opposition to the growing.
It could still be part of it.
Well, it's more apt to be a break in it. Oh. It was so marvelous how Marcel Duchamp died. He was reading a book of Alphonse Allais after dinner with friends, and then he was reading the book alone. The friends had left. And he was chuckling. And then he went into the bathroom to brush his teeth. And then he died. And the chuckling was part of the growing. But the dying, could have happened some other time. Well, that's again a question like, which is more important? When you ask a question about relations, then what you will get if the question gets answered is you'll get one thing rather than the two that you might have had. You will remain richer if you don't ask that question. My teacher was Schoenberg, and he was surely involved with strict relationships between things. And I'm working in a way that gives up those relations, but I think it's just as strict. And I like to say to myself that I've remained faithful to his teaching, and that if he were still alive, I could persuade him that that was the case. And the thing that made me feel that I might be successful in that conversation is that years ago, when I was studying harmony with him, he sent us all it was in a class at UCLA, he sent us all to the board to solve a problem in counterpoint. And he said, when you have a solution, turn around and put up your hand. And I did it. And he said, that's correct. He said, now give me another solution of the same problem. And I did. And it went on that way for 8 or 9 solutions. And finally, with some confidence and some trepidation, when he asked for another solution, I said, there aren't any more. And I had always worshipped the man. But now what he said made him, so to speak, ascend. He said, what is the principle underlying all of the solutions? And it's my feeling now, that is to say, if I were talking to him now, I would say, I think the principle underlying all of the solutions is the question we ask. And that if we get to the right questions, we will get, of course, the right solutions. But if we persist in asking superficial questions that have only to do with titillating the ego, then we'll go on having the miserable kind of situation that we're in. I think there was insufficient applause.
Oh, what is it?
Have you and Fuller ever worked on anything together?
I've known Bucky Fuller since about 1949, I think it was, when we were together at Black Mountain College. And we worked at the beginning on a production of a play by Eric Satie called Le Piège de Méduse, Medusa's Trap. And Bucky Fuller was the Baron Méduse. I haven't worked with him on the subsequent projects of the World Game, but I am devoted to him. The question is was the Erratum Musicale of Duchamp important to me? It is, of course, and when I became involved with the chance operations and saw Marcel Duchamp in Venice, I said, oh, Marcel, you did all of this practically the year I was born. And he chuckled and said, I must have been 50 years ahead of my time. Well, it's been very nice to be with you.